comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Well, it looks like we've got some kind of weird something happening. There we go. Something weird happening with the software again. All right. Well, we got that corralled. Welcome to the show. And we have folks literally around the world that are tuned in. Thanks for being here. I appreciate you being here. I'm delighted you're here, and I think you will be as well. Don't forget to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter if you haven't done that. It's called K-Files. Just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. You'll see the link that says K-Files. It's free. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. Let me encourage you, if you haven't joined our members area, be sure you do, because as a member, you get a whole lot more stuff than we can possibly offer for free. Now, we offer a lot for free. There are a lot of shows out there where you cannot even listen to their live show for free, but you can hear. And almost none of them allow you to listen to their latest show, the one they did, the one they just finished. But ours you can for the next 24 hours after we finish the show. That's free. But you get a lot more stuff in the members area. It's only 23 cents a day. So if you're not a member, be sure that you take care of that as quickly as possible. $6.95 a month. And, by the way, that price hasn't gone up over the years, and we are endeavoring to hold it right there at $6.95. It's a great value, so be sure, if you haven't joined, you be sure to take care of that. Hey, do you remember when the Star Trek series first came out, and, you know, it was Captain James T. Kirk? We began to hear things, and things entered our vocabulary that we had not previously been acquainted with. Things like warp drive and things like impulse drive, impulse engines, etc. Remember that? And, of course, the succeeding Star Trek versions that came out also talked about those things. Well, have you ever given any real thought to what is impulse drive? What is an impulse engine? Does it really exist? And if it does really exist, why aren't we using it for space exploration? What's the deal? Well, researcher, author, and inventor Henry Kroll has been with us before, and he's going to be with us tonight. And we're going to talk about these impulse engines. And we're going to talk about one that he constructed at least a partially working model and maybe a fully working model of an impulse engine. And we'll talk about how they work and what benefit would they be to us. And has anybody ever used these before? Is this something absolutely new? We'll be back right after this. We'll be right back. Henry Kroll has been with us before, and in fact, a couple of times, and it's my pleasure to be able to say to him, welcome back to the show. We're delighted to have you, Henry.
Well, thank you very much for having me on again. I'm glad that somebody likes my material. But anyway,
speaking of engines, because at the top of the show, I told folks we were going to talk a little bit about impulse engines. Folks need to know that in addition to being a researcher and inventor and author, you're also a ship's captain and a pilot. And you rebuilt your airplane engine on your dining room table, right?
Well, not quite. I actually used a sheet of plywood and two sawhorses in the kitchen, but anyway, I had bad luck with it. It's eating the pistons right now. I've got to get new cylinders bored out, 15,000ths oversized, and get oversized pistons and rings. And it turned into a nightmare, basically, and cost me a few extra $1,000. And now I've got to go Anchorage and get the work done. And all this stuff kind of makes me angry. I'm angry that we don't have ships right now that you can just step aboard, punch up through the atmosphere at 2 G's for about 5-10 minutes and go anywhere in the world in 30 minutes. You know, we have the technology. We should be able to do that right now, but they want to keep us earthbound so that we can be their slaves forever, I guess.
All right, and that's what I want to talk about. You said we have this technology right now, and we'll come back to that technology, but let's talk about some futuristic technology that you've had a little bit of experience with, and that's this impulse engine. Because
when I was growing up in Seldovia, I went to a friend's house, and I saw this ancient book. It was published in 1910, but it was copied from ancient Sanskrit texts that were falling apart, and it's titled Vimanika Shastra. And it's written by, or translated by, a Maharishi Rajaraja in ancient India. And the Sanskrit Translation Institute in Mysore, India, was the publisher of the thing. And I wrote to them and got a brochure on the book, and I have a copy of the book. And they had illustrated it with 1,800 drawings of what they thought that they were talking about. But these are translations from ancient books that were translated from before time, from ancient Sanskrit to Hindu, and and then to English. So it's been changed three different languages 3-4 different times, so it's really difficult to understand what they're talking about. Some of the words are the same, such as natron and the pitha, that is a cast iron floor of the ship. Apparently they were like flying saucers that they could travel anywhere in space or around the world in thousands of years ago. And the engine of the thing, they talk about spiral iron pipes, and they talk about it making noise like a roaring lion. Well, I got to thinking about Toth, and that thing in every doctor's office hanging up on the wall all over the country. You have a central staff with two snakes wound around it. And that was used by Toth, who was also known as Hermes. And the reason why doctors used it is they use a hermetic oath for to cure the sick. And that's what Hermes did for a while. And anyway, Hermes was also known as Toth by the Egyptians. And he had lived thousands of years. And he probably lived all the way up to the present day, you know. King Arthur's Merlin may have been taught. I hear rumors to that effect. But anyway, he used a device with a primitive man would have drawn those with snakes, because they looked like snakes, but they were actually spiral iron pipes filled with mercury. And I got looking at the device, and I thought that what would happen if you rotated this thing and filled it with mercury? It's angled upward at an angle of about 19 degrees, and the snakes are connected at the top or the pipes, and the mercury would spiral up the pipes because centrifugal force would force it outward, and it would climb up the spiral. And as it reached the top, it would pull back in because the pipes are curved back in 180 degrees and to the central column, so that the mercury would climb up there very fast and then be pushed back in. Well, there's forces known as the Coriolis force and the centripetal force, and of course your centrifugal force would make it climb up there. But when you, like an ice skater pulling its arms in, the mercury as it goes back down the central column would tend to make it go faster. So I got looking at it and I thought maybe this has some over-unity potential where it might actually run itself once you started it. So then I started thinking about how you would build such a device. So I have a metal lathe in my shop. It's about 10 feet long. It's a South Bend big old lathe, about 16-inch swing. And it has a taper cutter on the back of it, which is a long slide-like device with degrees mounted on it so that you can select different tapers. And I looked at it, and the maximum degrees was about 18 and a half degrees that it would adjust to. So I welded a series of pipes together to make a form to bend these spiral iron pipes. And I bought some schedule 40 small 3/8 pipes and some 3/4 inch schedule 80 for a larger model. And I was going to actually try to build one, but the technology to build one is very difficult because the spiral is tapered. And I cut the taper on this mold about 4 feet long so I'd have something to bend the pipes around. And I welded tabs on there so that the spiral would be even. And then I built a forge about 7 or 8 feet long out of hot water tanks. And I would fill that with charcoal and run propane in there to heat this pipe evenly so I could bend it around the form and get that spiral perfect, you see. In order to build it, you have to bend several spirals, and they have to be exactly the same. They have to weigh the same, and then you'd have to weld them together on the central column to where they would be perfectly put together. And then you'd have to balance the thing between live centers on the lathe, dynamically balance it, because it have to be perfectly balanced, otherwise it would fly apart. And then tie rods would have to be put onto the spirals also in order to keep them from spreading due to the centrifugal forces. But anyway, the math involved on this is, I looked up impulse engines, and many graduate students have worked this out, where these impulse engines are basically a flywheel with a weight kept on one side, and there's various techniques of doing that. And they would did the math on it. It works out to 3.8 newtons of force per watt, and that translates into English at around 112 pounds of lift per horsepower, which is 6 times more efficient than a rocket engine.
Okay, now, let me ask you, if that's the case, and if these physics students have worked this out, why are we not building these and using them for space exploration?
Many people have demonstrated these and actually showed them to NASA, and I think they use a similar device to move their spacecraft around. They have to have these, and to move their spacecraft, they have to have these gyros, at least 3 of them, in order to stabilize it, to keep it from just drifting off course, you know. Mm-hmm. All of them have these gyros, including the ones that we use for telecommunication. But anyway, there probably is people that have put these together and used them. And I searched around to find the mercury to put into this thing, and looked around for small, compact, 100 horsepower electric motors. And they're just now developing some of these for cars, And I was thinking, well, you take the wheels off a Chevy, and you got the electric motor built into the wheel, and you just use that.
Okay, so now, if it develops 6 times more thrust than our rocket engines.
That is an impulse engine. Well, impulse engines stop. Some of them have, like, run down a track with a ratchet on them so that the weight throws one direction and it moves inches forward that way, and then the ratchet keeps it from moving back. But when you're dealing with a liquid metal in pipes, there is no impulse. It simply climbs up the spiral. So it would probably be twice as efficient as that. It would be about 12 times more efficient than a rocket, or about 200 pounds per horsepower lift. I would estimate it would be double because there's no impulse, and that would give it over-unity potential. It might run itself, so you'd have to start it with a DC motor, and once it got going, you'd have to have a way of breaking it by shutting out the motor.
All right, now, in preparation for the show, I did some research on impulse engines, and what I discovered is that there are a lot of different definitions for what an impulse engine is, at least out there on the Internet. There are people that have developed a jet engine that pulses, and they're calling that an impulse engine. There are people that are calling an ion drive an impulse engine. And then it seems like the prevailing view is that you have to actually have two fusion reactors to somehow create an impulse that is fired out the exhaust or back of the spaceship, and that then drives the spaceship forward. What are we talking about when we talk about an impulse engine?
Well, I may have used the wrong term there. It's more inertial pulse engine. IPEs are called, abbreviated IPEs.
Okay.
And that's what I'm talking about here. And anyway, I mentioned the three forces that are involved in this, the Coriolis and the centrifugal and the centripetal force. Well, there's actually another one that we don't understand entirely. When you run electricity through a wire, it produces a magnetic field on either side of the wire, so you can make electromagnets by simply winding it in a coil. And the more turns you have, the more magnetic force you have. But when you're dealing with a conductor that's run through a pipe, it doesn't produce a magnetic field, it produces a time anomaly that can extend outward from the pipes itself, and depending on the speed, it might actually alter space-time.
Now, has this been done?
I'm pretty sure this is how it works.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with, you're familiar with Bob Lazar, you probably had him on the program. They have this element 115 that is very large and unstable, and the weak force actually extends beyond the range of the outer electron orbits of the atom itself, so they can not transmute that into element 116, and it decays very quickly into antimatter, sending a tremendous energy radiation in a layer of gas at the bottom of a cone. And this gas energy turns into high-voltage electricity, then is used to amplify the weak force of element 115 so that it extends in an invisible envelope or outside of the spaceship. Well, this is sort of a time thing. It creates a time field out of the element 115. Now, to reduce the gravity or mass of a ship to go extremely fast, possibly even faster than light speed, you need to reduce the mass down to that of a photon or less to exceed light speed. And I believe this is possible. I have a lot of this data in my book, and including Bob Lazar and Charles Brush and a Palin, a Michael Palin, who did the math on gravity. He's a wheelchair-bound mathematician that was fascinated how people could alter space-time with their human body just by picking up his wheelchair with their fingers. is Marshall Payen, P-A-Y-A-N.
Okay, now, when you say it creates a time distortion, what are we talking about there? Does that mean you could travel in time?
Our particular time that we exist in is regulated by our solar system and the speeds that we are traveling through space. They found that further out away from Earth, and the faster you travel, it alters time. The astronauts are actually are younger after they land by a few minutes than if they had stayed on Earth. So our time is variable depending on the speed or the energy that you are, forced into. We exist in a certain time field, but if you can alter that time field where you are at your present position, then you can actually not attract to gravity. If you alter it enough, then you can reduce your mass down to nothing, practically nothing, and exceed light speed, possibly. Now, Team Hubble came up with an actual, this surprised me actually, that they'd even let this information out, that they came up with a mass for a photon. It's 5.81 to the minus 66 grams. And it's a very small number, but photons are very numerous, and there's one E100 of them per atom in the cosmos. That was their estimation. So if you can get something that weighs less than that mass, then you should be able to exceed light speed or even, double it or whatever. And you can do that by simply altering the time field around you, which most of our physicists say is impossible. They think it takes too much horsepower to do that or too much energy. But it's done naturally by various elements and also possibly bismuth, because they've done experiments by dropping these bismuth and other elements and measuring the rate that they fall, and it varies because they have an interaction between the atomic structure and the gravity waves.
All right, we have to step away for a break. And when we come back from this break, we'll continue talking about this exotic idea for propulsion systems. Welcome back. We're talking with Henry Kroll this evening, and we're talking about these impulse engines and how they could be constructed in a way where they could be used for spacecraft. Henry, let me just ask you right off the bat here as we come back from break. Do you suspect that these engines actually have been developed and perhaps are being used in secret?
I believe they were a long time ago, 1930s. Guglielmo Marconi, he had to leave Italy because he was playing around with this stuff. He had a yacht that he lived on for some time, and he had several assassination attempts on his life. He was the inventor of the telegraph and sent messages across the Atlantic, for those who aren't familiar with Marconi. But he grew up as a little kid in Italy, and he started experimenting with static transmitter devices. They're very fascinating, man. Anyway, on this Mercury spiral, let's just do a couple little numbers on there. Say Mercury weighs about 112 pounds per gallon, and if you can run, say, 1,000 gallons a minute up to 1-inch pipes, where it travels up the pipes and then back down the central reservoir, you're simply circulating or recirculating 112,000 pounds of mercury a minute. And I think you could do that with less than 100 horsepower.
And what would be the effect of that? I mean, what? Let's say we circulate it. So what? What would that do for us?
Well, you're moving from a horizontal position to a vertical position. It travels up the spiral, you see, and develops velocity, and then it's pulled back in at the top because of the configuration or the shape of the pipes itself. So this would tend to make it spin faster. And then it also, you're running the conductor through a pipe, so it creates an odd time anomaly that is tapered in form. And this might actually reduce the mass of your spacecraft. So you'd have to have a way of controlling it, possibly with a braking system or using DC electric motors that you could shut out and take power from. But anyway, I believe this was developed by Marconi and others. And in order to steer this or control the craft, you have to mount this inside a container, like a round ball or a steel shell of some kind. And then you have to be able to tilt the container in different directions, about 20 degrees, so that you can travel different directions, 20 or 30, and have stops where it would only tilt so far so that you couldn't over-control. And then the larger models, you'd have to have servos because you couldn't steer it by hand. The forces would be so strong that muscle power wouldn't work. So you'd have to steer it more like a hydraulic boost system, like in a helicopter.
All right. Now, what you're describing sounds eerily similar, at least to me it sounds similar, to what the Nazis were doing in World War II. We've heard about the Nazi bell, and they were using mercury for something. And there was some kind of spinning device. Do you know anything about that Nazi bell program?
Yeah, I do. I've looked at the shape of their device, and it works more on a vacuum instead of an actual forcing the material around. It's an odd-looking thing, and it's a vacuum chamber. It creates its own vacuum lift somehow or another. I don't know exactly how that works. But it also creates an odd field around it, and people that are standing near it get sick. Some of them have died, and they were working on ways of shielding it, I understand, from the videos or whatever I've seen. And
now, they weren't using, apparently, were not using any kind of radioactive material. So what sort of field could cause their sickness?
I think it was a time field, because if you're standing near it, part of your body would exist in a different space-time, and they were just getting ill from it. Now, the Philadelphia experiment was also very similar. They used a series of Caduceus coils mounted around the perimeter of the ship, from what I understand, in a 60-kilowatt DC generator down in there to power the whole thing.
Okay, now, Caduceus coil, if I understand correctly, would be similar to what you've been describing with the emblem that's used by the doctors. Is called the Caduceus.
Right. It's, in a way, it's similar, but I think the old Vimanas, their design is much better. The one used by Toth or Hermes, it's just more developed. The electronic Caduceus coils that they had around the ship on the Philadelphia experiment, they were uneven, the fields around there, so that the men on board got deathly ill, and they did alter time some way, because they report that the ship could move extremely fast through the water. People on the outside could see that it just would move 1,000 miles an hour, and the people on board the ship, they thought they were in normal time, and they could see the water look normal out to about 100 or so feet away from the ship, and then further out it looked like concrete, like cement. But the military value of such a project was tremendous, because they could take an aircraft carrier and put it on the other side of the world in a few hours, traveling 5,000 miles an hour, 2,000 miles an hour with it. But the Eldridge, or may have been a different ship, whatever ship they used, they couldn't use it anymore after they got done with the thing. It was flickering in and out of our present space-time. and the people on board, they had to, a lot of them died, and they had to put up the rest in an asylum, and they couldn't allow them to talk, and they didn't understand what was happening to them.
So how could this thing be used practically then? Because if you used it, yeah, you could send your aircraft carrier, but then all your people are dead.
Well, if you could produce a field that didn't have holes in it, a constant field around the ship, like pumping up the molecules of the iron and making them so that they were the time field was even, and then there would be less damage to the people on board, and it would reduce the mass of the ship, and it wouldn't... you see, the time field they created was actually altering the water itself out to about 100 feet away from the ship to where the water existed in their time zone.
Mm-hmm.
But out further, it looked like concrete because they were traveling 1,500 miles an hour. And there were observers on the pier where they came in, saw the guys running around like crazy, like ants. They couldn't talk to them or interact with them. Then they untied the ship and went back out and to their original location. But they were traveling at extremely high speed, and they couldn't, and the people on board the ship couldn't see the people on the dock, from what I understand. This is just material that I've read and videos and movies and things that I've seen on the subject, but I've tried to research. All the best brains on the planet were part involved in that thing. Townsend Brown and Einstein and Oppenheimer and others, and, you know, Tesla. Tesla started in on it, and then he didn't want anything to do with it after they got started because he realized the danger of it and didn't want to be connected with it. He wanted to do it a different way, and they wouldn't do it his way, so...
Well, do you think after they did the experiment, do you think that it's possible that they saw, well, yeah, the concept works, but Tesla was right about the problems with it, and then maybe, perhaps, went back to Tesla and his technology to do it the way he wanted to do it? Do you think that ever happened?
I don't think so. Tesla was in his 80s at the time. He was quite old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he just wanted out of it, and he kind of wanted this peace and quiet and privacy.
Well, you know, it has been said that following his death that the government confiscated all of his notebooks, all of his papers, everything. And I just wonder if maybe they got that technology, his brand of that technology, through those notebooks and papers, and maybe they've got the ability to do it today.
I don't know. They're not even sure who took his papers. It could have been the Nazis, you know. There's a museum over in Europe, the Tesla Museum, that has a lot of his material in there on display.
Mm-hmm.
And some of his relatives, I think, are involved in the museum. But that's about all I know on that subject, you know. It's
all right. Well, let's go back to that Nazi bell. Do you think, because there's been a lot of speculation about this, do you think the Nazis were able to perfect a flying disc?
Oh, I definitely do. There's enough material out there on the internet and YouTube of showing these things up in the air. And, you know, some of them, of course, are drawings, but there's actual photographs, and some of them are pretty clear. And then a lot of your sightings were in America and also in South America. They traveled specific routes, you know, over Antarctica and different places where they could have had bases, and they still may have a base in Antarctica, possibly.
All right.
In
well, you see, the Nazis were all, I'll use this term, they were eaten up with a desire to find everything they could find about Aryans. Well, the Aryans, and a lot of people don't know this, were not white. The Aryans were brown-skinned people. they were Asian. And they inhabited the areas of today, we call it Tibet, and India. And
India, yes.
And so they sent expeditions over there. Now, it's quite possible that, you know, they read all these Sanskrit documents about Vimanas. And, in fact, I would say it's likely. And then I wonder then, would the bell be their attempt at a Vimana?
Well, I think it was a different design, and it didn't work out well for them at all.
Mm-hmm.
Although it could have been more of a remotely controlled device. The Kecksburg crash may have been one of those Nazi bells things, you know. You're familiar with that one.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I mean, you've studied this, the history of this technology, you've followed it. Do you think anybody has successfully built what the Sanskrit texts call Vimanas?
I don't believe they have this mercury spiral like I described it's in every doctor's office in the United States. You know, I don't think they've actually built that. They could have, but I've never seen any evidence of it.
Mm-hmm.
This is all my speculation by simply reasoning what would happen if you rotated the device and then doing the math and figuring out what kind of lift you would get. I started looking around for sources of mercury, and I found a place in Illinois where I can order it wholesale using a corporate credit card.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll pick up right there when we come back about the source for mercury. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Henry Kroll, and we're talking about, I'm calling it exotic propulsion systems. Henry, now let me ask you a question about this mercury. You said you found a source for mercury?
Yeah, it's a wholesale source. It comes now in plastic tubs that weigh about 100 pounds. And the environmentalists don't allow them to fly it anywhere, so the only way you can transport it is by truck. And you have to use a corporate credit card to get the stuff. I was going to have some of it flown up to Alaska, or trucked up to Alaska, I should say, but it was expensive, you know, close to $1,000. So a neighbor, a friend of mine, told me that, why don't you go up to Alignaget? There's a stream that flows into another stream called Dillingham. It's a town up there called Alignaget. And there's a native village up there, and it's a wonderful resort area for hunting. There's quite a few lodges. And so I decided to fly up there to look for some mercury. Now, this banker, Elmer Rasmussen, had a mercury mine up there in 1948. And it was cinnabar, and they brought the ore down to the Alignaget River, and they stored it along the stream bank, and theoretically the mercury, it was so rich the mercury ran out of it into the salmon stream. And supposedly you could see the mercury in the bottom of the stream. Well, I put 6 5-gallon cans of gas inside my 1948 J3 Club and started flying up there with enough gas so I could make it back again. And it was quite a long trip, but anyway, I flew up along Lake Iliamna and around the lake and over to Dillingham and up the Alignaget River, and finally got there and took some gold pans with me and called some of the locals, and they put me up for the night. Were very friendly and very nice, and I tried to pan for some of the mercury, and all I could get was a few drops, you know, so that the whole trip up there was a waste of time for me. They claim that it's so much mercury was spilled there that it was in the air, and that the people have it in their blood. It contaminates, it's quite toxic, I guess, but over periods of time. And anyway, they had stored the mercury contaminated ore in fish totes on along the stream bank, and of course the water got in there and broke the totes open, so the mercury ran down into the gravel, and they just simply covered it up with plastic and put more dirt on top and erected a chain link fence around the area. But I couldn't get enough there to do any kind of experiments. I got maybe a teaspoon with several gold pans full up there. And that's was the extent of my trying to get some mercury.
What's the attraction to mercury to make this device work? Why mercury?
Because of its high specific gravity, you could use any conducting liquid. You might be able to use sodium or salt water, but it doesn't have the density, you know, its specific gravity of water is 1, and this is 112 pounds per gallon, so when you're pumping it, you're really moving some tremendous mass, you know, like mm-hmm. 50 tons a minute. If you're just moving, say, 1,000 gallons a minute, 1,000 at 112 pounds per gallon, you know, that's mm-hmm. 112,000 pounds.
Okay, now, you wouldn't actually have to pump it, would you? I mean, just by spinning this device, it would cause it to flow upward through the tapered and angled pipes, the spiral, and then it would be, by its own force, forced back down through the center, right?
That's correct. It would just flow, gravity flow, right down back to the larger reservoir in the center. And I think the device itself could also be used as a heart pump or an artificial heart in a human being, except for the fact that hearts require the pulse to keep things loosened up.
Mm-hmm.
The beating heart in a human is necessary to keep the blood flowing and keep the clots from forming. So a continuous pump like that doesn't work for any great length of time.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't injure the blood cells.
Now, do you know of any examples of this type of, I called it an impulse engine. I think you called it, what, inertial?
It's a continuous impulse engine. There is mm-hmm. no impulse. It's just basically a pump due to its physical shape. But I use the math of an impulse engine because that's the only thing that's available, an IPE, an inertial pulse engine, I meant to say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you know of any examples of one of these, a working model, having been built?
No, none. It could be used as a pump or any, you know. I registered it with the patent office. That was years ago, so I guess it's up for grabs. Anyone can make this thing and use it as a pump for any purpose. It would probably pump solids, or if it was big enough, you could use it to pump difficult things that would wear out a normal pump.
You know, something that you said earlier has actually been nagging at me since you said it, and that is that the regulations will not allow them to fly a shipment of mercury. They have to put it on a truck. Well, more trucks crash every year than airplanes.
Well, you know, this is just the way things work in America.
It sounds dysfunctional to me.
The guy that had this mercury mine up there, old Elmer Rasmussen, he became a very rich banker. He was president of National Bank of Alaska for many, many years. And that there was a rumor that he took this ore down to his yard in Anchorage, Alaska, and was retorting in his backyard, and he inhaled some of the fumes, and all his hair fell out. But that's the rumor, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, mercury is toxic, and but they used to use it for fillings for teeth. And back when I was a kid, they were using mercury in fillings for teeth.
I think I still have some of them.
Well, they say it's pretty toxic.
Mercury both.
And but mercury has been recognized as having almost magical properties for centuries, for millennia. The first emperor of China, in his tomb, had right in the center is his, where his sarcophagus was, where his body was. But then all around him was a map of his empire, and all the rivers and everything flowed with mercury. And they've actually uncovered that. And so it was legendary for a long time, but now it's not legendary. It's they've confirmed it. And, you know, it flowed with mercury. Many civilizations have talked about mercury. It's also sometimes called quicksilver, as having almost magical properties. And I am wondering if that is because they saw beings from some other planet using mercury in engines like what you're talking about.
Well, the guy that actually used this thing was known as Mercury. That was Thoth, Hermes. They called him Mercury. The Romans called him Mercury because he was swift. He could fly around and deliver messages and cure the sick. But anyway, the Russians found some glass goblets. They were very odd shaped. They looked like they were made in India. And they had mercury in them and wires going to them. And they probably were mercury switches designed to keep something going in a straight line. They had if the mercury bubble moved over to one side, it would connect the wires and electricity would flow through in that direction, which would force it over to the other side. You know, it's kind of like an autopilot to keep a spacecraft flying in a straight direction.
Mm-hmm.
Those were quite interesting.
All right, now you've read quite a bit about these vimanas, and for those of you who may not have used that word, and Henry's used that word, but we didn't describe what that is. That's the word in the ancient Sanskrit manuscripts that describes what we would call UFOs or flying machines. They were called vimanas. You've had a chance to take a look at quite a bit of information on vimanas. I've got a question or two about those when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome to those of you who are joining us just now in the second hour. My guest this evening is Henry Kroll, and we've been discussing basically ancient technology that could be used to power spacecraft, and we've been talking about what the ancient Sanskrit manuscripts refer to as vimanas, and I have a question or two for you, Henry, about the vimanas. You are a pilot, and not only are you a pilot, I mean, you have a knowledge of engines and how to build them, how to rebuild them, how to invent things. As you have read about these vimanas, does it sound to you like just fanciful mythology, or like they were describing actual functioning aircraft of some type?
I'm definitely sure they were actually functioning aircraft. In fact, they probably were more advanced than the writers could describe. And I don't know, you mentioned earlier whether or not you think that our government could possibly or have created such spaceships that can travel. Well, if you remember back during the Roswell era and other times, they had a live alien little gray guy, and they may have made a deal with him to X-ray technology. You've heard all of this stuff before. I'm sure everybody has, but there's a website called serpo.org. Have you read any of that material?
Oh, yeah, I've read all of it.
Serpo.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've read all of it.
It sounds true to me for a number of reasons. And one of them is they wouldn't take our American astronauts, 12 American astronauts, 10 men and 2 women, to their main planet because their main populations were highly, many millions of people. But so they actually took us or our astronauts to one out in the wilderness somewhere. It didn't have a lot of people, and it had 500,000 inhabitants on the planet. It was smaller than Earth, and there wasn't much water on it. It was much a climate kind of like around Phoenix, Arizona. And this is why I think it has some merit of being true, because they wouldn't go to their more populated planet. They would pick some off in the boondock somewhere, because if we did develop the technology to go there, then we would kill off their main population. You see, they're afraid of us. This is why they took us out in the boondocks to show us around. You see, that deal they made with us.
Hmm. Now that's that is an angle that I had not thought of. That makes sense, though. Yeah, we'll show you a little bit of who we are, but
it had some merit of being. Now, I thought it was true because of that. You see, there was very little water on the planet. I guess it had one ocean or something like that, and it had an Arizona-type climate. It was quite hot. They were suffering most of the time they were there because of the temperatures. And there's one expedition they talk about where they went up north, and they allowed them to carry a revolver around. One of them shot a creature that looked like a snake.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of upset about that, but anyway, I don't know if they ate it or not. Can't remember that part, but anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, I have heard people...
Space travel to where... Go ahead.
Well, I've heard people say that, the basic story is true. However, there are a few details they got wrong, and that it was not actually called Serpo, that it had a different project name. But these people that said that, you know, the basic information was true information. And they are people who should have been in a position to know, and they said that was the case. All right, I want to open up the telephone line so that as you and I continue to talk, our audience can join in with us. Now, folks, you've got a couple of different ways that you can join us. Of course, if you're in the USA or Canada, the way to join us is by telephone. And the main number is 623-444-5889. And you can dial that actually from anywhere in the world. We have a toll-free number if you're in the USA or Canada. It is 888-223-4599. Now, if you're somewhere else in the world and you want to call us, you can just use the telephone and make the international long-distance call and call us at 623-444-5889. If you don't want to pay for that, then there are a couple of routes you can go. If you have Skype and you have that account where they allow you to dial telephone numbers, you can use that, and that will only cost you a couple of cents per minute. And you can call us at that number, or you can use our flash message option on the website, kevinsmithshow.com. Just scroll down, and you will see the flash message option. You'll just see a link that says flash message, and we'd be more than delighted to hear from you. Why do we have rockets? Why are we not using something more advanced than rockets? Apparently, the technology has been around for quite some time. Is this advanced technology actually being used elsewhere? And by elsewhere, I mean out of public view. Is it being used by what some people have referred to as our secret space fleet? Is that a possibility? Well, I guess nearly anything is possible. But what we're hearing from Henry tonight is that actually the technology to build this type of engine, while it is a little bit of an engineering feat, the technology to build it certainly would exist now. And Henry, what's interesting to me is that apparently it existed thousands of years ago. And we are perhaps just now arriving at our past.
Well, we have the metallurgy, you know, the steel is strong enough to build this stuff, I believe, but it takes a lot of engineering to put something like that together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've always been cursed with the ability to just build about anything or to engineer about anything, so this is why I decided to try to build one. But I never got around to finishing it because I couldn't get enough mercury together without, I didn't have enough money to go throw around at buying this equipment and also the resources. But anyway, I wrote about it in, I put it in my book, Cosmological, and how we can go to other planets or match some of the feats that are mentioned in the articles about traveling 38 light years to Serpo.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was very fascinating, and that further on, if you do some more reading, they came back in a more advanced and a larger ship in 3 months.
Yeah, I recall that. Okay, let's go to the telephone, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
This is Brent from Wyoming, Kevin.
Hi, Brent.
I'm going to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
You're asking why we don't use that technology?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the Apollo 11 when they left the moon? I don't think there was any rockets, were there?
Yeah, there were rockets on the underside of the module they were in.
I didn't see them. I don't remember seeing any rocket, any exhaust stream or anything.
Yeah, when they take off, you can, if you watch the videos, you can see a flame coming out of the bottom of it just barely.
Okay, I just thought they might have used something like that.
Well, they claim it was rockets, and you can see evidence. Really? If you watch carefully, you can see on those videos evidence of the rocket underneath the module.
Yeah. Okay, just a thought.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Bye. Yep. Bye.
Bye. All right, 623-444-5889 or toll free 888-223-4599. I know I'm asking you, Henry, for speculation here, but how far into the future, if we don't have these, let's say we don't have any of this type of engine that you're talking about, and tomorrow they decided, okay, we're going to start building one, how far into the future would it be, do you think, before we have one working and able to propel a spacecraft?
I think we have them that work now. Our government does. In fact, the lunar lander may have had some anti-gravity technology because there's no dust on the landing pads. I sent you an email with photos of the conical gold-plated landing pads, and there's absolutely no dust on them. It's like they were blown clean.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no blast crater to speak of underneath the lunar lander, so it kind of makes you wonder if Martin Marietta or whoever designed the thing is actually using anti-gravity technology up there on the moon to land it.
All right, let's go back to the telephone and caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, Kevin, this is Mark from Ohio.
Hello, Mark.
Hello. I wanted to ask Henry, what actually causes the anti-gravity effect with his machine? Is it that tremendous spinning speed or rotation that's causing the anti-gravity?
No. As far as I know, it's the time. You alter space-time around you. You create a time field, and you don't attract to gravity. You're not altering gravity. You're altering time. You can travel out away from the Earth for, say, a tenth light speed for 1 year and come back. And everyone on Earth will have aged 10 years, whereas you've only been away for 1 year. It has to do with your present position where we are in space.
So is it the rotation that affects time?
Mark, we can barely hear you. Speak directly into your telephone.
Sorry about that. Is it the rotation that
I don't believe it's. I don't believe it's the rotation. I think it's the conductor, liquid conductor, flowing through pipes. It's opposite from running electricity through a wire that creates magnetism. You run a conductor through pipes, you produce a time anomaly, a field of time.
Well, Henry, good luck. I mean, that's absolutely fascinating, and I hope you can actually build the thing. It would be fantastic. And I'll see you guys later.
All right, Mark, thanks for the call. 623-444-5889 or toll-free 888-223-4599. Or if you're outside of the USA, you can and you're outside of Canada, you can either use Skype to call that number or you can send me a flash message, all right? So we get a reverse effect, sort of. If you run electricity through wire, we create a magnetic field. If we run a conductor through pipes, instead of a magnetic field, we get a time dilation. So
the only reason that I have some sort of a grasp on this at all is because I wrote the book Philosopher's Stone years and years ago, and I did a lot of research on that, on these warm atoms, and they have paired electrons orbiting in opposite direction, and they're passing each other at twice the speed of light. So they exist in multiple space-times depending upon their charge, and they're passing each other at twice light speed, you see, and you can put more electrons into orbit and get more of them, and they'll disappear entirely from our space-time. And it exists as a white powder. You can spread it out on a table and heat it up with a torch under glass, and it'll disappear. You can write your name in the invisible substance, and then when it cools off, there's your name. It's there. It's just you can't see it. It's in a different time, in a different space. And it's very difficult for human brain to grasp this stuff, but it's very fascinating. Everybody's familiar with the two-particle experiment and how they can communicate over vast distances and exist in two different places at the same time. It's a little bit like that principle. It has this non-local property where it can communicate with itself and other particles like it over vast distances all the way to the other side of the galaxy instantaneously. The communication is sent. So this is the ideal medium to send messages across the galaxy to other star systems, and also to alter your mass, reduce your mass down to zero so you can travel faster than light speed.
Well, now, see, you've brought up something. You've brought up something that I've talked about before, and that is that I think it's a waste of time to be scanning the heavens looking for radio signals from extraterrestrials, because if they're traveling at light speed or faster,
idiotic, personally.
Well, yeah, if they're traveling at light speed or faster, they would be outrunning their radio signal. And it, why send a signal if you're going to get there before the signal does? So it does, that makes no sense to me. But now you're talking about the possibility of quantum communications.
Exactly. The nearest inhabited star system might possibly be Sirius, and it's 8.5 light years away, so it'd take 8.5 light years for a signal to get there, and then somebody'd have to understand it and send another signal back before you could receive it here on Earth. And 16 years is a little, or 17 years is a little ridiculous to for communication, for local communication. So you need something that can work on one planet second to the other side of the galaxy. And this Orm Adams has that potential, and it exists in nature. It can be found in certain streams. There's deposits of it in Colorado. David Hutchin was manufacturing the stuff. And it's very simple, but nobody seems to understand it. You just simply put it in a box like an Ark of the Covenant, and you generate this Shekinah glory, or cause it to create an electron cascade, and that can send out a signal. But you have to be able to modulate it into some sort of a audio or a visual signal to that can be received and interpreted on the other end in an identical type of device, wherever it may be.
What is this substance called?
People have figured this out.
What is this substance called that you're talking about?
The Ark of the Covenant.
No, the substance that you're talking about, the white powder. Henry, the white powder you're talking about, what is it called?
That's the white powder of gold. It's Orm atoms, orbitally rearranged monatomic elements,
mm-hmm.
or also known as the Philosopher's Stone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a white powder, and they, every time they open one of the structures in ancient Egypt, they find it laying all over the floor and on the ceilings, and they ate it in their bread and their food to make them live longer and extend their lifespans, and also make them more intelligent. So anyway, it creates a magnetic frequency within your body where you're not quite the same as anybody else. You vibrate at a little different frequency. And apparently Moses and other priests could concentrate on this thing at a distance and create an electric spark between these cherubim mounted on top of the device. But I got to thinking, what actually is taking place here? What if you had a 2,000 IQ and were able to produce, practice with this thing a few hundred years and produce actual holographic images out of charged particles or electrons, and you could send that message with a beam antenna somewhere to an identical device somewhere else instantaneously, and you wouldn't have to wait hundreds of years for the signal to come back, you see. And they came here to mine that gold and burn it into this white powder, and then they ate the stuff for longevity.
All right,
and
now,
seven recipes in the book, Philosopher's Stone, how to make it, take it out of sea salt and granite powder and limestone and Great Salt Lake precipitate and other sources, but I get it out of seaweed up here, put it on my garden. It's a whole technology. It takes a while to understand what's going on there, but it's all done with a physical shape of the particle. It's shaped like Saturn, with the counterposed electrons are called Cooper paired, and they're passing each other at twice light speed, so it really doesn't exist in our space-time. It resonates magnetically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it works on Planck's constant, E equals HF. You take a frequency, a magnetic frequency that operates in the gigahertz range, very, very high frequency, you can get a tremendous amount of energy out of that, E equals HF. Just look at the formula and multiply it out. I mean, under the terahertz of ordinary matter, a lot of it resonates at a very high frequency.
All right, we have a flash message from Kevin in Australia with a couple of good questions here. He wants to know, how would this spinning double spiral with mercury in it, that engine, how would that work, for instance, if you wanted to use it for an underwater craft, like an unidentified submerged object? Would it work underwater as well?
As far as I know, it'll travel in any medium. It's not dependent on air or any medium to travel. It's just an inertial engine, but there's no pulse involved. It's a continual force, inertial force. Inertial pulse engines, IPEs, have actually been demonstrated to work, and they're just a weight on a flywheel that rotates, and you flip it over after the flywheel turns so far so that the weight remains on one side of the flywheel. And each time that happens, it creates a little pulse in that direction, so it produces a linear direction. If you hook that up in a canoe or a ratchet set up to where it can't go backwards, it'll travel along a track. And they're quite efficient, I guess, as far as the thrust goes. They claim to be six times more efficient than a rocket engine from the graduate students that have made these things. And there was a guy on Coast Radio, I believe, that had built one that fastened to a skill saw that had three different types of traveling weights. And he turned it on, and it made such a racket, he almost got evicted out of his apartment. He was an retired engineer, and used a three-horsepower skill saw motor.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back right after this. The telephone lines are open for you. Or toll free 888-223-4599 in the USA and Canada. Or if you're outside of the USA and Canada, you can send us a flash message, and I'll be glad to read it so long as it pertains to tonight's show, and we'll get Henry to comment on it. Now, Henry, Kevin in Australia had a second question. And his second question was, would this a craft that's using this engine that you're describing with the mercury flowing up the spirals, if it was using that engine, would it inside, or would it be kind of like the TARDIS on Doctor Who? You know, it looked like a phone booth, but when you opened the door and went inside, it was much larger. Would it have that effect? Well, I guess I have lost Henry. Hang on a second. Let's see if we can get him back. Henry, are you with us? Okay. Well, we will try to get Henry back. And, caller, your first name, and from where are you calling?
It's John from Vancouver Island.
John, I would suspect you have a question for Henry. All right. We're trying to get him back online here. And Henry, are you back with us?
Hello.
Yeah. Can you hear us okay?
Hi. Back on.
Okay. Go ahead with your question, John.
Mine's dead.
Oh, he can't hear us. He must be getting close to something.
I guess so.
Yeah. Just hang in there. Let's see if we can get him back up here.
Okay.
All right. So we'll... we'll see if we can't get it at least where he can hear your question or your comment. And Why don't you whistle or sing for us, John, while I do this, and then we'll have a little entertainment.
You wouldn't want to hear me sing, I can tell you that.
All right.
I didn't get a whole lot of your program this evening, so I wouldn't mind Henry's website just so I can take a look at stuff.
Yeah, we did have a little bit of problem with I'm having some trouble with software. I think perhaps I've picked up a virus that's corrupting software on my computer, where I was not able to get the Henry's picture up on the site tonight. I created it, but I wasn't able to get it into the web page.
Yeah.
So we'll be working on that after the show, and it will be linked.
Yeah.
Henry, are you back with us?
Yeah, I'm back on, finally.
Okay. As I was saying, we must have gotten close to something, and maybe somebody didn't want you to say it. We have John on the line with us, and he's from Vancouver Island. John, go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, Henry.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
I didn't really hear a whole lot about what you were saying, but the little bit that I have heard really floors me. But I'll just say this much. I've been following zero-point energy concepts, and I arrived at Nassim Haramein's site, and he talks about the vacuum fluctuation. And he talks about energy densities in the vacuum that calculate to 10 to the 94th power grams per centimeter cubed, which is a fantastic number. And what he says is the reason we don't steal that amount of energy is because that energy is in equilibrium. Set between expansion and contraction. And so my question is, would you know any way, assuming that would be true, to kind of create a disequilibrium and tap even a small amount of that fantastic amount of energy that apparently exists in the vacuum?
I don't know of any way personally. T. Henry Morey had a device with 29 valves in it that were similar to transistors and hooked up to a regular radio antenna above his house and was pulling several kilowatts out of there to power his house for years. And they were simply like diodes, but he used a mysterious zinc oxide type of diode that he found over in Sweden. And it's been lost. People just, government doesn't want it, and they had several attempts on his life. So I believe he was actually tapping into this 10 to the 94 gram energy that's just out there. I mentioned some of that in my book, Cosmological Ice Ages. But what I was concerned with here is just, being able to travel to other star systems. So I actually did the math and tried to figure out what 2 milligrams moving at 1/10 light speed would do to your spaceship and how you could avoid it, So I was more into the interdimensional stuff by creating these time fields to where you didn't react with third-dimensional matter. You could pass through it, possibly. There's a guy named Marshall Palin that talks about having seen mass penetrate other mass, like stick a pencil through a glass container, and certain psychics could bend spoons and do all of these weird things that our science can't explain, and it's simply done with a human mind. And they just don't understand how it works, if we can just create this time field where you don't exist in third dimension or whatever, then you can travel extreme speeds through space. That if you're in our present state of, just 2 milligrams moving at 1/10 light speed produces an energy of 909 joules, which is 900 gigajoules. That's the energy equivalent speed squared times mass. And if your ship were made a solid diamond, it wouldn't survive a hit from a 2 milligram mass at 1/10 light speed. There's just no way you could possibly do it. So you just have to exist in a different time zone. You know, that's the only way I can explain it.
Okay. John, thanks for the call.
Are we still on the air? I can't hear anything on this end, you know.
Henry, you cannot hear me? Henry, can you hear me now? Okay, I'm going to put you back on the air, and we'll see if you can hear me. All right, can you hear me now? Well, that's weird.
I got you.
Okay. All right, 623-444-5889, or toll-free 888-223-4599. And let's see if we have anything on the flash message board. We do not. Okay, so the whole idea of using this particular type of engine is not only that it creates a whole lot of thrust and can produce then a lot of speed, but it does so at the same time it's creating a time dilation. So you're sort of slipping through third-dimensional matter. Would that
be
right?
That's correct. You can avoid being annihilated at high velocities.
Mm-hmm. And that would be important.
So you're...
That would be very important. Because, you know, if you had something...
The only way that I can come up with...
Well, if you had something the size of a BB that struck your ship and your ship was traveling at, say, 1/4 the speed of light, it would be enough to...
1/10 the speed of light.
Even at 1/10. And it would be enough, that would be enough to destroy your ship, right?
Your survivability, the probability of you surviving for any great length of time traveling at 1/10 light speed is very, very small. It just cannot be done, you know. So therefore, you cannot get anywhere within our local group of stars. It would take you many, many years to get 8 light years at 1/10 light speed, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But then you'd be 80 years getting there. 8 light years. So, you know, there's no way to do it without altering your time or extending your lifespan hundreds of years to travel slower rate of speed. You just have to create a time field around your ship and bump it up to where it doesn't react with third-dimensional matter. Now, this sounds complicated, but I think it's much simpler than we can imagine.
Why do you think it's simpler?
Well, we just don't have the mental capacity to grab it, you know. I've got the math here in front of me. I have this book, Cosmological Ice Ages, almost 400 pages, and I put all the data in there, how we could travel to other star systems in book two. It's a two-volume set, sort of. And kinetic energy is 2 meters squared times velocity squared, and that can be shortened up to KE equals 2 meters squared times velocity squared. You'd have to use this formula to find your terminal velocity, and then you go on from there to find the acceleration of gravity in meters per second. It's all in the book. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. All right, now...
into how much energy it would take and how many barrels of crude oil it would take to get somewhere.
Okay, but now... Let's talk about putting your engine. Let's use the engine you described at the beginning of the show. You put it in a spacecraft, and you got to spin that engine. And how would you get the power to spin that engine?
I would simply use batteries or possibly a fuel cell. You know, Chevy already had this electric car called the Volt, and it has these electric motors built right into the wheels of the car, and I believe a fuel cell to drive the thing. And I was hoping they'd get that on the road here by 2012 and maybe take one apart and use part of it, or be able to order the parts from your nearest auto parts store and build a spaceship out of it. But anyway,
okay, so
there's
this would
ways of generating electric power. You know, you could use some helium-3 or hydrogen fuel cell or whatever, and if the thing is over unity, which I think it is, it would generate its own electricity, and you could store it in batteries to get it started again. You see, it depends on how much you would need at the time.
Okay, so it would not require a great deal of power then, once you got it spinning.
To get it up to speed. Yeah, in that ancient Indian text of Vimanika Sastra, they talk about using a heat to get it moving some way or another. Maybe, I have no idea, but it's been translated from 3 or 4 different languages from ancient Sanskrit, so, you know, the meaning gets lost. But they talk about maybe they use wood to fire the thing up, for all I know.
Mm-hmm. Well, what seems to us to be a very primitive technology can be used to produce amazing results. And, you know, maybe they were using steam power to get the thing spinning. That's a possibility. You know, and like you say, maybe they had to use wood. We'll be back right after this, so don't go away. And when we come back, we'll still have the telephone lines open for you. 623-444-5889. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Henry Kroll. Bob in Australia has this question for you, Henry. And let me just make sure you're still with me. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Okay. Bob in Australia wants to know, with this sort of power, could they not fabricate a force shield to protect the ship at light speed? That would be the easiest way to travel to the stars. So with this type of engine, could this engine perhaps create a force shield around the spaceship?
I don't think a force shield is practical unless you could take the kinetic energy from the atoms out there. There's about 3 billion atoms per cubic meter in empty space. It actually has a certain amount of mass. That's why some of the Voyager spacecraft are slowing down, is because of the amount of actual mass out there that they're running into. So, anyway, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to 900 kilojoules, you know, to like 2 milligrams of something moving 1/10 light speed. It's tremendous energy. It would slow you down, and there's no way to convert it into thrust or speed. You just have to be able to go through it or avoid it some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
We have no technology to create such a shield that I know of, you know, either magnetically or electronically. However, you know, we did a lot of figuring on this. You know, there's all the numbers are in the book. You take helium-3 fusion energy is capable of producing 18 million electron volts in a small reactor. And 9 grams of helium-3 would produce the energy equivalent to 1,000 barrels of crude oil. Now, Dr. Maglick and David Sarita of Green and Blue Corporation have devised a way to magnetically contain a helium-3 fusion reactor reaching temperatures of 8 trillion degrees. There's little or no radiation, and the process is safe, they claim, because when the magnetic field is broken, the fusion reaction simply stops. It's not like an atomic reaction that keeps on going and melts down to the core of the Earth, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
Anyway, we have the technology to produce the thrust to go at 1/10 light speed, but we don't have the way of surviving any great length of time. The only thing that we could come up with is to send probes, for example, over to the nearest Sirius star system at 8 light-years away, would be to use, say, 100,000 microprobes with microelectronics in there, and these little pieces about 1 inch diameter and 10 inches long, and maybe 2 or 3 of them would get through out of the 100,000, and you could actually get some close-up photos of whatever happens to be over there.
All right, let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
In Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Two questions. When is somebody going to build one of these and try it out? Let's stop talking about it and start doing it. I'd like to go on a ride in one of these things. How much longer till we build one?
So would I. You know, that's why I started to build one, but I ran into problems with getting all the materials together, such as the mercury and the money involved. You know, I don't have a lot of money to work with, but
right.
Anyway, we are developing nanotechnology so we can send micro miniature probes out to other star systems, possibly, with nanotechnology.
Well, and the government doesn't want us to do that. The powers that be would rather keep us here so they can have more control over us. Have you heard of Charles Hall, by the way? The Charles Hall photon theory? It kind of sounds similar to what you're talking about.
Yes, I have his books. I have copied his math on that. I don't have it here, but in my other place across Cook Inlet. It's very interesting. I really enjoyed his books. They were really funny.
All right.
Well, he claims that the aliens use the same thing. So, there's no research money available for this because they want to keep us here under their control. They don't want us to explore the whole galaxy. So, well, I just wish somebody can build one of these things. And Kevin would like to go on a ride in it too and do a first radio show from a spaceship.
That's right. Yeah, so, Henry, if you build one, I want to ride along so I can broadcast live from there. All right. We have time maybe for one more quick call, but it has to start ringing right now or we're going to run out of time. Henry, I'm going to, after the show tonight, work on the software and get you linked up on our site. But go ahead and tell folks where they can get your book.
Well, Cosmological Ice Age is available from Trafford, Trafford, .com, /books, I guess. And I have two websites. One is Guard Dog Books. That's all one word. And GuardDogBooks.com. And also AlaskaPublishing.com. And they are available on Amazon and Borders, but I don't make much money when you order from there because the rich dudes all get cut, you know.
Yeah.
From Trafford, I do better. And anyway, I'm hoping to make a little bit of money on the book so I can buy some pistons for my airplane, my 1948 J3 here, and put it back together.
A little hard to fly without an engine.
Spacecraft. I've been working on it little by little, you know. Just.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, listen, I think that you have done a tremendous service just by looking into the Vimanas and how you could possibly build this kind of machine that they had, this engine they had. You've done a tremendous service just to research that and to get started on building it. Now, you said there was a mercury mine there in Alaska, and you went up somewhere near that mine. Are there still mercury mines up there? Could you buy mercury from one of them and have it shipped to you?
No, there's no operating mercury mines that I know of, no cinnabar mines. It's a red type of ore, and they get the mercury out of it by simply heating it in ovens There's none of them operating in Arizona either that I know of, but I have toured a couple of older ones there, and I saw their old retorts and stuff around there. They're wild horses, and nobody goes near there. I guess they're afraid of the contamination. And but anyway, yeah, there's no operating mercury mines. There's a zinc, copper, and gold mine called the Red Dog. And
yeah, but you really would have to have mercury, wouldn't you?
Gold mines, but
you would have to have mercury though for this engine.
Well, because of its specific gravity, and you know, mm-hmm. it's a liquid form, a liquid metal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. If your spacecraft cooled off, it would have to be quite cold before the mercury would freeze. But anyway, I think it's feasible. I think it's been used in the past. And there's quite a few logistics to be worked out as far as the mechanical device, you see.
Well, Henry, I wish we had more time, but we're right up against the end of the show. I want to thank you for being with me, and if you will, just stay on the line with me for a minute as I close the show. All right, folks, I thought you deserved to hear someone that's actually working with that ancient information to build a modern machine, a modern I called it impulse drive, and I understand now that's not exactly what it is. But, you know, a lot of this ancient technology stuff is for real. If you can take what they said and build it and it works, that's for real. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until tomorrow, so long, everybody.